Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
And welcome back to Boston Community Affairs on WEEI. Thank you, as always, for listening. I think we have a very, very interesting episode for you folks this week. Of course, our interminable presidential races just get longer and longer. In the Democratic primary, Iowa caucus doesn't even start until early 2020, but we already have roughly two dozen candidates in that field. And of course, with the primary season and the presidential race, what do we hear a lot of? We hear a lot of smears. We hear a lot of lies, especially with the man in the Oval Office. And to help us talk about the anatomy of a smear and how these lies, especially political lies and these political campaigns, take on lives of their own, we welcome in Lauren Cooper, who's an award-winning author of six books, including Chain of Ghosts, Resonance in Language, Story in the Brain, and Crosstown, which was nominated for the Nebula and shortlisted for the Endeavor, both for Best Novel. Lauren, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, it's great to speak with you. So I guess the first question that I have for you here, especially in this season, is the anatomy of a smear, how lies take on lives of their own. Just explain that process a little bit and why these words can take on a lot of meaning, even if they're deemed to be not truthful in the least.
Well, there are a couple of things, right? So if you start out at the fundamental understanding that we perceive the world, through narrative, even at a fundamental brain level, there's research that if you start with a premise and then you interrupt that premise in a way that is not logical but not perceptible at the introduction of the premise, across languages, across cultures, you get the same neurological response, right? Okay. So starting with that, if you can establish a narrative and that narrative fits into an existing narrative, the audience comes to the table.
Right.
That narrative will tend to stick even on the disproof.
Right. I get it. So it's about setting a narrative and then saying stuff that backs up the narrative. And it doesn't necessarily matter whether the narrative is truthful because it's all about getting the message out there, regurgitated through the press, etc.
Yeah. In fact, even if it's debunked, there's cognitive bias effects that you can actually strengthen an opinion that fits into somebody's existing assumptions.
Right.
Even if there's proof that this initial smear was inaccurate, was fictitious, you can actually bump the people that wanted to believe it and entrench them in that belief.
Well, I mean, I think a great example of this, and we'll, you know, speak in politics since that's, the main avenue in which we see this happen, but we see it happen all the time. But, you know, you talk about how people want to believe something. You look at the way we consume media now, and political media in particular, about how, you know, there are a million polls. Republicans primarily get their news from Fox News and Breitbart and Daily Caller and a lot of these pretty hardcore right-wing sites. Liberals, of course, find other outlets, and they have all these preconceived notions. And, you know, a great example, I think, in recent American history is Hillary Clinton, where for the last 20, 25 years, there have been tons and tons of smears and conspiracy theories and fantastical tales about the Clintons that have circulated throughout right-wing circles, and they've just been out there for so long, and they back up this preconceived notions that it could be something crazy, as in they, killed Vince Foster or killed Seth Rich, the DNC guy a couple years ago. I mean, they can be such outrageous claims, but they live in that right-wing ecosystem. They back up preconceived notions, and so many Americans believe them to be true. Is that a good example, a real-life example, as to what you're talking about?
Sure, it's an excellent real-life example. And the fact of the matter is, even being aware of cognitive bias doesn't escape it. So everybody has their preferences, and they'll tend to go to those sites that confirm their preferences.
Right.
And it's dangerous because many of these sites blur commentary and actual reporting.
Right.
And in commentary, you don't have that high standard, right, to try and stick to the facts. And even facts can be shaded. You can have presentation biases that are established.
Right.
The way to defend against this kind of thing is to...
Is to what? I'm sorry, Warren?
Is to take some time to challenge your sources, particularly your regular sources. And this is not very comfortable because we have so much stuff that's tailored to our preconceptions. So the best way to fight this kind of thing is to actually go to sites that potentially make you uncomfortable, right? So say you tend to hang out on Fox. You should check NBC and attempt to identify the commentators. Stay away from the commentators and multiple source checking, right?
Well, that's such a huge thing we have in our society about what is a verifiable source, what is a good source. I was reading a piece in the Associated Press just the other day where a middle school science teacher in Maine was talking about how difficult it is for her to teach climate change because she had never really learned it growing up, is not well versed in it, and the amount of information out there is just so vast, and so much of it is misleading. And you know, I think one of the biggest problems, and I would even say crises facing us today, is that people don't know how to decipher between a good news source and a bad news source. Like somebody like me, if I'm reading something off some crazy website like Gateway Pundit, let's say, and I've never heard of this, and they're saying something incredible about, oh, Hillary Clinton has pneumonia, or you know, or QAnon, or any of these just wild conspiracy theories, I know it's BS, but so many people don't because they don't have good news recognition skills, and I think that's such a huge problem, and I'm just not sure how it stops. I guess beyond just better education. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fundamental, and there is no panacea. Right? I mean, the reason these systems evolved in the first place is to be able to make decisions quickly, right? So if you think about it fundamentally, you don't need to temperature in your coffee every morning to know that it's hot if you see steam.
Right.
Right? So empiricism is handy, but because of the fact that there's all of these ways to frame information, there's all of this potential narrative that can be built, and those things can be put in a way where if you're a layman, it's very difficult to say what's credible versus what's not credible, that it does become difficult to parse.
Yeah, it totally does. And I just think, to go back to a point you brought up earlier, Lauren, a huge, huge issue is the fact that people just look to read news or read opinion that backs up their preconceived notions. We live in this bubble. We live in alternate realities where you can't even have a debate about these issues. Like a great example would be, you know, on the morning show that we do on WEEI, one of my regular sparring partners, Jerry Callahan, you know, is further to the, you know, is to the right of, you know, for one of the furthest right-wing people you could imagine, which is great, and we have really spirited debates. But, you know, when you talk about something like the abortion issue, we're just dealing on two totally different realities, taking quotes out of context, et cetera. I mean, another more contemporary example would be what we've seen with these two Muslim congresswomen, Omar in Minnesota and Tlaib in Michigan, their comments about Israel and the Holocaust. Now, those get distorted in right-wing ecosystems, and people just, again, they just look for information that backs up their preconceived notions, and because people don't want their bubbles filtered and penetrated, and it's just and it just leads to this vicious cycle, which I think is one of the greatest problems we face today in terms of a healthy democracy and spirited debate.
Yeah, you know, it is a great problem today, and the technology makes things incredibly complex, but don't think it's new, right?
Okay.
So rhetoric as the art of persuasion has been used to drive action for as long as we recorded history, and therefore before that, right? We have stelae from pharaohs that talk about making their opponents do the dog walk.
Okay.
Right? That, and so that's just basic dehumanization strategy that allows a more comfort with attacking the opponent. And this is the danger of tribalism, right? So you get to the point where the opponent or your adversary is not one of the tribe.
Right.
There's an underlying aspect of them not even being human.
Right.
And so at that point, your ability to persuade
right.
is extremely diminished.
Right. Right, right. If they view you as subhuman. Right. And
right.
Because people are not interacting with those who are different than them. They live in their online bubbles, and they become further
right.
radicalized as a result.
Right. There was actually an interesting psychological experiment that was done back in the 50s with middle school age boys. And some folks doing a study sort of took over a summer camp. And they broke the boys arbitrarily into two different tribes. One tribe was identified as the eagles. The other tribe was identified as the snakes. Mm-hmm. And they set up zero-sum competitive events that would shower praise on and benefit on the winning tribe mm-hmm. and would denigrate and drop the position of the other tribe. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, that study unraveled to the point where the tribe that had been in the lower category were actually planning violence against the other tribe.
Wow.
Now, the interesting thing about that study is that they looked at how to try and break that pattern up. And so they put the boys into positions where they had to work on common problems for a solution that was critical to both tribes as a whole. And that was the only way that they could manage to break through that adversarial tribalism that had been built up. Now, the difficulty that we have today is that we have common problems, but in some cases, they're not recognized as common, or the way that they're addressed are so oppositional that we can no longer look at how we can address these things as problems.
What do you mean?
So, for example, let's take the legislation that's occurring around abortion rights.
Sure.
Right? So Roe versus Wade.
Yep.
So, part of the conservative drive to stack the courts with conservative judges is to look at undermining Roe versus Wade, because there's a very strong moral argument that life is sacred on one side.
Right.
The other side, they have abortion out there, but they're completely oppositional, right? And so their value set is also positive, right? But it's framed around choice mm-hmm. and the life of the mother.
Right, it's how you
right?
frame it, yep.
And so, but by framing this, there's no look at what's the common problem of issues, or what's the common problem with unwanted pregnancy? What's the common problem of the ability to support the people that you already have out there?
Yeah,
they're not framed that way.
Right,
you're either pro-life
right.
or pro-choice.
Right,
there's no way that you can get together and address an underlying common root issue because
right.
you've never identified it that way.
Right, you're framing.
And that's a classic framing problem.
That's a great point, right? You're really talking about two different things. They're framing
exactly.
framing it in two totally different ways. Yeah, I mean, that's a great way to look about it. And again, I think it goes back to news consumption, and it depends on what you're reading, what you're watching, and what viewpoint you're getting, which is why I just keep going back to and one of the biggest things in our society is the fact that people just stay in their ideological bubbles, and there's no common agreed upon facts, which means that debate dies, and I think it's very bad for democracy. A question I have for you, it's more of
sure.
a general question, is, you know, you talk about truth. What is exactly the meaning of truth, and has that always been what we make it? Because we hear so much about fake news, that's such a word now, but has this kind of stuff always been around, and it's just been amplified in recent years with social media, et cetera?
You know, it's interesting. I don't want to sound like a relativist or a complete academic, But truth itself doesn't have a single definition.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Right? Yeah, exactly, here we go. Right? So a truth can be a proven fact. And at that point, you've stripped it down to something that's empirical. Right? However, a truth, or something that's true, can also be defined as a belief accepted as true. Mm-mm. That's where we get into trouble.
Okay.
Right? So this problem, again, has always been around. So there's different methods historically for arriving at truth, right? And the belief was, prior to Aristotle, that you could derive truth through pure reason, right? So this is the Platonic ideal, where you have an idea that is so pure that the only sign of it in reality is just a reflection or a shade of that idea. Mm-hmm. And so to get at truth, it's not something you can measure, it's something to think your way to. Aristotle comes along with classification, and out of Aristotle, eventually, we derive the method. Now, the scientific method is a way to break through paradigms, right? So the scientific community will have an accepted set of conclusions that are derived from experiment, validated through experiment. And when those get overturned by another experiment, that scene is adding to the body of knowledge. Mm-hmm. It is not seen as something that's bad, right? It's actually seen as something that's good. That's a discovery. But the scientific or other empirical methods are very cumbersome. This is back to that early comment around when you get up in the morning and you have your cup of coffee and you see steam coming up, but you know it's hot.
Yeah.
We operate much more efficiently that way, but that kind of processing is really easy to subvert. And so those truths that we know are the truths that are most dangerous.
Go ahead.
Hopefully, I mean, I kind of talked around that, but hopefully that gets to your question.
Yeah, no, I certainly understand that. But then, you know, don't you come back to the question that facts are facts? Like to use a contemporary example again, you know, we 99% of scientists, whatever it is, believe that climate change is real and humans play a role in it through carbon emissions. You know, but you have totally one sect of our you know, population, and certainly one sect of the political aisle that denies that, even though the science is not in their favor. So that would be truth as to how they interpret it. But then can't you go back and say, but, you know, facts are facts? Like, I guess there's understand how there can be two different sets of, like, aren't there just one set of facts? Like, isn't there just one scientific
consensus? Well, so if you look at the language that scientists generally use, empirical frameworks, the more that you begin drawing conclusions is the more that you'll see them hedge because of limitations in terms of measurement, limitations in terms of modeling. And that makes perfect sense, right? But the problem is that allows enough uncertainty that someone else, driven by a different impetus, particularly if they look at, say, that issue or observation threatening their industry,
right?
Then they're going to look at, oh, well, so there's a certain amount of uncertainty, and that lets me challenge that particular set of conclusions.
Sure, which is why you have a lot of, you know, coal companies funding studies that, you know, cast doubt upon you know, man-made climate change. Or back in the 90s, tobacco companies would, you know, fund studies to challenge, to push back against, you know, nicotine is harmful. So, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, and but the interesting thing about it is, again, it comes kind of down to the issue, right? So how do you identify sufficient risk with that certain of play, right, in a way that can be worked commonly by both sides. Mm-hmm. What we're really good at is framing these things as complete opposition. And, you know, you were talking about kind of debate being healthy, but it falling by the wayside. In some ways, what we don't have is debate as discussion. We have debate as entertainment.
Right.
And you get players on both teams. They come in. They work their rhetorical points. They're not trying to persuade one another.
No.
They're trying to persuade an audience and bring someone over to their side.
But the audience is already entrenched on their side. There's really no
persuasion
going on.
Right. Well, that's why I said it's like entertainment. Right? It's like who can score a win? This is not working a problem in common. And
no,
that's
absolutely.
Why those kinds of debates that are framed in ways that are oppositional do nothing but actually further entrench tribalism.
Right. No, I guess what I was talking about more of, a productive debate, which is what you were talking about, a debate that turns into...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. When you're talking about a discussion, when you're working on a common problem, but if you don't identify what the common problem is, then you've got problems.
Right.
Right.
But again, it goes back to that. It's impossible to have constructive conversation or a constructive discussion if you're working off two different sets of facts, which is what we have, unfortunately. And because people get so trumped up, like, you know, I've been using all right-wing examples. I'll show equal opportunity. I'll go on the left, like the last couple years with this Russia investigation and the Mueller report. If you watched MSNBC, every single night, they're just hammering home the Mueller report, Trump conspiring with Russia. Now, I believe a lot of that is based in reality and is based in truth and facts, and we have a lot of facts to back some of that stuff up. But clearly, it did not reach the grand levels that it was perpetuated from, the Steele dossier and some of the outlandish claims there. But it makes for good television. It gets people trumped up. Because then you forget, too, about these cable news networks in particular, Fox and MSNBC. They're playing to older audiences. They're looking to, excite and incite, in a lot of cases, those audiences. So what do? They want to make the best, most riveting, dramatic television possible. And their regard for the truth is way down on the list.
Priority is to sell advertising dollars.
Yes. Well, and to me, Lauren, that's one of the worst things that's happened to this country when news became for profit. Like back in the day, in the 50s, 60s, I mean, you know as well as I do that all the major networks were fine taking losses in their news division. In the moment that news, again, became for profit and became about entertainment is when I think you can really trace to where a lot of the stuff started to go awry.
Right. No, I concur. When the fairness doctrine was eliminated, it really unleashed the opportunity to drive this for-profit news engine and accelerated where we're at. And that comes down to this piece that competition is a good thing and that corresponds with industry, right? The base idea of capitalism. The problem is again, it's how you frame it. Competition has its place. Cooperation has its place. And when you're talking about these discussions and the values, when you have corporate influences in, their first priority is the bottom line. And so anything that threatens the bottom line potentially clashes with their priorities, and that's going to drive funding for research that's going to try and support their further production of profit.
Right. And I think Trump has a great understanding of this, and we mentioned earlier in our conversation about the importance of, really the power, I should say, of setting a narrative and saying things to back up that narrative. And I think all these nicknames that Trump has for his political opponents are great examples of that. You go back to the Republican primary. What was the narrative around Jeb Bush? Well, he has no energy. He's boring. He stayed. Well, low energy Jeb. Boom. It sticks. Ted Cruz comes across a very pious guy. Lion Ted. Boom. It sticks. Now, you know, him going down some of these Democratic opponents. Elizabeth Warren. What has dogged her for years? The Native American ancestry question. So we call her Pocahontas and we feed into that narrative. So I think Trump doesn't understand much, but he certainly understands how this media ecosystem works and does a great job of exploiting our biases. And then the partisan press just runs with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, he's using really fundamental rhetorical devices, right? So that kind of thing, from a logical perspective, is an ad hominem fallacy, right? But from a rhetorical perspective, it's extremely powerful. You tag somebody with a particular narrative, and it's sticky. And that can, again, just build that reinforcement. of the existing narrative that's already in place. And so that can be a powerful tool. He's very adept at using it.
Go ahead. So how can we combat this, Lauren? Of course, as I mentioned, the 2020 election is not until November of 2020. Here we are, May of 2019,
yep.
But already is dominating our news cycle and will only get worse. So how can we
right.
fight against all this? It seems like the system is stacked against us, stacked against truth. How do we fight back, Lauren?
Well, I think one way is to identify commentators and tend to stand them. The speed of the news cycle should itself be a caution. Avoid fast decisions. The better they feel when you see a headline is the more that you should be aware that you're confirming your existing bias.
Mm-hmm.
We all like that. It's an emotional feedback loop that, you know, you're confirming the narrative or the conclusion that you've already built up. The other thing is try to check neutral sources. So in addition to checking opposing sources like the main cable news sources, yeah. things out there like AP, Reuters, BBC, for somebody that's outside their perspective, that doesn't mean that they don't bring their own friends to the table.
Right.
But by checking multiple sources,
sure.
you can get closer to what the inciting sort of event is associated with.
Right. I totally agree with that, but I would say that a vast majority of Americans just look at their Facebook page, they see their friends post stuff, they read it, and that's it. They don't have the time or want to have the time to go check multiple news sources.
Yeah, I don't disagree, and that itself is a problem.
Yeah. No, it's
right.
It's
always been difficult to be a responsible citizen. And at one time, the classical the idea of the trivium and the quadrivium, which were the core sets of things that at the time, of course, generally an educated male would have because it was restricted to property-owning males, right? So not all good. We're talking about coming out of slave societies and the like,
yeah,
right? But the fundamental idea was that education was imperative in order to be able to make informed decisions. And it was no paradise. If you read the early democratic going on in, say, Athens during the Peloponnesian Wars, it makes our rhetoric these days look tame in comparison.
Really?
Yeah, the chains were off. I mean, literally, there was no fact-checking. It was all about public oratory. And so what you see in some ways with this move to this virtual channels with the commentators and less emphasis on fact is actually a move back to much older styles of public discourse.
Right. No, it's certainly frightening, certainly frightening. Lauren Cooper, the author of Chain of Ghosts, Resonance and Language, Story in the Brain. First of all, Lauren, how can people find this book and your work?
So, Chain of Ghosts is available on Amazon, and Crosstown is available worldwide from independent booksellers, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, virtually every major channel.
Excellent. Lauren Cooper, again, really enlightening conversation. I could do this for a while. I'm sure we'll have you back again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, thank you so much. Enjoyed the conversation. That was Lauren Cooper joining us here on Boston Community Affairs on WEEI. My name, of course, is Alex Reamer. I'm not sure if I formally introduced myself at the start of the show this week, but you all know this voice by now. As I said, I could talk to Lauren about these kinds of issues for literally hours on end, because I think it is one of the most pressing crises that we face as a democracy, and I experience it every morning with Jerry. We'll talk about a hot-button political issue or social issue, whether it's abortion or the Mueller-Russia probe, or go on down the line. And we just are operating off two totally different sets of facts. And when that happens, it is impossible to have constructive debate or a constructive conversation. It is impossible to change minds, and people just live in their own ideological echo chambers. They do not challenge themselves. They fall victim to propaganda, and they interpret propaganda and commentary as news. And there's really no way out, and as far as I'm concerned, not to be a pessimist, but I think this problem is only going to get worse as people become more socially isolated, they become more tribalized. I mean, that's the thing, too. People spend all day alone on Facebook and social media, not interacting with others, and they just become increasingly radicalized because they're increasingly alone. And I think it is a very dangerous thing, and it creates this atmosphere where lies can become truth and lives can be perceived as facts, as we are seeing multiple times per day in our political discourse right now. So, again, big thanks to Lauren Cooper. Very much appreciate him coming on the show. As always, thank you for listening to Boston Community Affairs. If you have any ideas, send me a note, alexr@weei.com. Happy to entertain those. So long, folks. Thank you again for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.